So how do you know there's a God? I found myself in conversation with someone during the earlier part of last week who has some experience, certainly more experience than I have, of the skills of those who are actors. And we were talking together about the amazing ability an actor has to take a few words, exactly the same words, and by mode of expression, make those words mean very different things, sometimes almost opposite things. And yet most of us, even though we're not able to control our voices in that way, are able to use exactly the same words and convey totally different meanings and feelings and emotions. And that's true of the title of our study tonight. There's many different ways you can say these English words. How do you know there's a God? They could be words of intense anger, words intended to end a discussion perhaps between a Christian and somebody who isn't a Christian, as though these words silence the issue. How do you know there's a God? And walk away. And we will return to that presently. They could also express an almost entirely different point of view and certainly a different spirit. They could be the expression of somebody who has begun to find their life drawn to consider spiritual realities, eternal things, someone who has become dissatisfied with their life, who comes to somebody that they know as a Christian and asks the question, how do you know that there's a God? When what they really mean is, how can I discover God in the way in which you have so obviously discovered him? And I want us to try this evening to think about these words in a number of different ways. Obviously, this is a most basic question. And those of you who are students will, I'm sure, from time to time have been fascinated in things that you have read about the way in which this great question, how do you know there's a God, has so dominated the intellectual tradition of the Western world. Every great thinker in one way or another in the Western world has asked this question and tried to find an answer. And some of you will be familiar with the great classical answers of the classical philosophers. The answer of a pre-Christian like Aristotle in the 4th century, who believed that everything was in a kind of state of flux, but behind that state of flux there was an unmoved first mover. Or the great 11th century Archbishop of Canterbury, Anselm, who developed what came to be known as the ontological argument for the existence of God that still fascinates philosophers in the 21st century. Or in the 13th century, the famous medieval scholar, philosopher, theologian, Thomas Aquinas, who in his great works employed 5 different kinds of arguments for the existence of God. Arguments that the philosophers and scientists in one way or another today still continue to discuss. But the fascinating thing in the midst of all this is that you search in vain in the pages of the Bible, the great book about God, you search in vain in the pages of the Bible for any of those arguments. And yet there is no book in all the world more confident in its proclamation of the existence of God and of the character of God and the works of God and even of the attitude of God towards us as individuals. Here, interestingly, in Romans chapter 1 is the greatest of all Christian philosophers and apologists and theologians, a man dealing in many ways with a world full of religious questions and a multitude of religious answers. And I want us to try and think together this evening a little about the way in which the Apostle Paul comes to this question. Comes to this question, provides us with a striking answer, because he believes that there is a way of understanding the answer to this question that is absolutely inescapable. And his answer, in brief, is this: that we don't discover the existence of God at the end or as the conclusion of a logical argument, but in fact, the existence of God is the foundation for the possibility of any logical argument. We don't reason an individual to believe in the existence of God, because a conviction of God's existence is absolutely inescapable for every individual. In a sense, for the Apostle Paul, it's pointless to try to reason to the existence of God for an individual as to try to reason to the conclusion of that individual's existence. Because for him, the knowledge of God's existence, the knowledge of God's being, even the inbreaking of the sense of God's presence, is as inescapable to me as an individual as my own existence is inescapable to me. And it's very interesting to see in this discussion here, in which he is particularly thinking about those who stand outside of the Christian faith, outside of the claim to Christian revelation. It's interesting to notice the way in which this principle undergirds everything that he says and comes to the surface in those words that he uses at the beginning of verse 21. If you've a copy of the Bible and can look on, you will see it there in the opening words of verse 21, when he speaks about men and women and makes this extraordinary claim that they knew God. They knew God. He doesn't mean that in the sense that Christian believers have come into fellowship with God. He means that in the sense that there is a kind of knowledge of God which for him is absolutely, finally inescapable for every single individual who has ever lived. And about that, he has, I think, three things to teach us. Number one is this. The apostle argues here that there is a revelation of God's existence that surrounds you. He puts it this way in verses 19 and 20, that the things that are visible in this world reveal the God who is invisible. And he specifies some of the things that this world can tell you about the existence of God and even the character of God. It will teach you, for example, that the one who made this finite world is himself infinite. That the one who made this extraordinary world is filled with marvelous power. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. Indeed, he goes on in verse 21 to suggest that there is a kind of inescapable reality about the world in which we live, and that is that it is a kind of theater that displays the glory of God. And in the Bible, the glory of God usually means something like the physical expression of all the wonder of his personal characteristics. In a sense, he is saying, there is nothing about God that he has failed to imprint on the world that he has made. That is to say, to put it another way around, this world has got stamped into it and all through it the words made by God. And that is simply, says the Apostle Paul, an inescapable reality. There is nothing in this world, as Herman Bavinck, a great Dutch thinker of the 19th century, once said, there is nothing in this world that is in the final analysis truly atheistic. Because everything that God has made inevitably reveals to us something about God's being. It is, in Paul's words here, in verse 19, plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. And the point he is making, let me repeat it, is this. That the knowledge of the existence of God is not the conclusion of a logical argument, but the inescapable given of the world in which we live. As a revelation of God, it is impossible for any individual, no matter what he seeks to do, ultimately to escape from the inbreaking of God's revelation of himself in the world that he has made. There is a marvelous poem in the Old Testament in Psalm 139 where David describes that reality like this. He says, "Even if I could take the wings of the morning and travel with the speed of light in order to find somewhere to escape from the revelation of God, when I landed, as it were, when I made my soft landing, having traveled at the speed of light, I would discover wherever I went that there was a face staring at me from everything in the universe. And that was the face of its Creator, Almighty God." Or if I can put it another way, no matter how much an individual may declare himself to be atheistic, to deny the existence of God, he cannot, she cannot, in the last analysis, escape the fact that God has implanted into his created order, just because it's a creation, little time bombs that explode in our lives that make it impossible for us to live consistently without drawing down borrowed capital from this basic reality of our lives. And it manifests itself in a thousand different ways. You read the work of a humanist biologist who has no time for the presence of God or the idea of creation. And what do you discover him doing or her doing? As they seek to provide you with an absolutely atheistic interpretation of the universe, you find them, without exception, attributing the most remarkable intellectual design to creatures that they have already told you have no power of intellect and no power of design. And invariably you will discover them appealing just at that point to what they so often call the wonders of Mother Nature, with capital letters. Now, what's the point I'm making? The point I'm making is that they cannot think, they cannot write, they cannot reason consistently with their atheism, because the world doesn't fit that. They are pressed into speaking about the extraordinary ability of non-rational creatures to do the most extraordinary rational things. As Paul says here, what happens, you see, when someone turns away from worshipping the great God who created everything, is that he ends up bowing down before the creatures that God has made. And here you have men, undoubtedly of brilliant intellect, men who have done marvelous things, and what a delight it is to watch some of the things that they have done, their exploration of the wonders of nature. And they will bow down before a slug rather than bow down before God and say, "Oh slug, how marvelously you've designed yourself. What glorious things you have done." And then when the book comes out, you remember that they have just said that this slug doesn't have the brain much more of substance than a peanut, utterly incapable of design. And you see what is going on here? God plants these time bombs into the way in which he has created things so that it isn't possible to describe this world with real consistency without the recognition of the presence of God, the power of God, the Creator. And so, invariably, the secular biologist will appeal to Mother Nature, to some transcendent reality that he or she can disguise by using this homely expression, lest they embarrass themselves by using the dreaded word, the living God. And for reasons that we shall see as we go on. And there are so many illustrations of this that one could use. The recognition that there is written into the created order, if a man will just turn it, as it were, upside down, these three words, made by God, there is an inescapable revelation, says Paul, a revelation of God's power and of God's character that surrounds every human being. And he is going on to say this, and for those of us who are Christians working in the non-Christian world, this is an extremely important thing to know. He says you will discover that the person who denies that this is true, who repudiates this revelation of God, must spend much of his energy denying a truth that he or she knows in the very depths of his or her being to be true. So there is a revelation of God that surrounds you, says Paul. And then in verses 19 through 21, he goes on to say in the second place that there is an awareness of God that invades you. Now look at what he says here in verse 19, which I think is not well translated in the New International Version, because Paul makes a very important distinction in the language he uses here. He says, what may be known about God, and this is the version most of us are using, is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. But in the text that Paul is writing, he wrote in the Greek language, what he says actually is this. What may be known about God is plain in them because God has made it plain to them. What may be known about God is plain in them because God has made it plain to them. And he's saying here something that for him is of immense importance. That not only do we live in a world that surrounds us with the revelation of God's being and character, but in that world, we ourselves as individuals are invaded by God's revelation, and we cannot escape it. As somebody has put it, in this whole matter of revelation, we are not merely spectators of the drama, but actors in the drama. We are not only, as it were, spectators of what God does in his revelation of his being in the world he's created, but we are part of that created world, and according to the Bible, such a distinctive part of that created world that God's revelation of himself actually invades us. Now let me try and explain to you where Paul got this idea from. He was somebody who had given a great deal of time and thought to the opening chapters of the Bible in the book of Genesis. And particularly words that are found in Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Where we're told that when God made man in the beginning, he made him as his image and likeness. As his image and likeness. And that for Paul means that by very definition, if we are created as the image of God, then there is something about us that expresses both dependence upon God for our existence and is a kind of reflection of God in our being. Put it like this, you look in the mirror tomorrow morning if you dare, when you get up. If you move away from the mirror, the image disappears because the image is absolutely dependent on the original for its definition, significance, and presence. And Paul understands that exactly the same is true of you and me. We are made as the image of God. We are made dependent on God. We are in some sense so connected to God. In what Genesis calls the likeness of God. That there is no way in which we can escape the fact, no matter what we do, that God has, as it were, penciled, engraved his autograph into our very being. I don't know if this is still true because I haven't bought it for a multitude of years, but those of you who are of my generation, you remember when you went on holiday, your friends expected that you would bring back a stick of rock. And there were always, at least in most seaside towns in Scotland, two qualities. There was the rock that told you the name of the place on the outside, on both sides, but if you broke it open, it was white all the way through. That was the cheap version. And then there was this higher quality rock that no matter where you broke it, those words at the end, Blackpool Pier or whatever it was, you broke it open as many times as you could, and those words were written all the way through. And it's something in that way that the Apostle Paul thinks about what it means for us to be human. That God has not only generally displayed his character and power in the things that he's made in the universe, but in a sense he has got one particular showcase in which he reflects what he's like. So that I can't really, as it were, escape in my own being from this sometimes gnawing sense that God is, and that I myself am absolutely dependent upon him. And again, it's very interesting for me anyway to notice the extent to which it's true in those who seek to deny the existence of God, the power of God, the goodness of God, the love of God, the very being of God, that they cannot live in this world without constantly falling back upon this truth as though it were true. And again, there are so many illustrations of precisely this kind of thing. Why is it at the end of the day we look at the universe and there is an instinct in us that wants to praise? That's not a distinctively Christian emotion. That's a human emotion. But what is it doing there? It is an expression of that deep-seated instinct within our very being that there is somebody there to praise. It's not just that God has revealed himself beyond us. It's that God has made us for himself. There is this deep-seated God sickness within us. That whenever there seem to be moments when God puts on the lights in the universe, we stand in awe and wonder. We want to stand on our tiptoe and say thank you to somebody. All the while we may be denying that there is somebody there to say thank you to. We ask questions which begin with the interrogative why. And not just questions that begin with the interrogative how, scientific questions, how did this happen? We ask such questions as, why did this happen? Why do we ask those questions? It is a deep-seated echo within our being that the universe in which we live is a rational universe, and when things go wrong and out of kilter, there must be some explanation for why it is like this. Many of you will know the name of Richard Dawkins, perhaps the most vocal secular humanist in the British Isles in the last decade or so. I remember reading an interview in one of the newspapers with Richard Dawkins in which several things emerged. One of them was this. He was asked what he would say to parents whose child was dying of cancer. When they asked the question, why is this happening to our child? He would say to them, don't even think about asking that question. That's an altogether inappropriate question, but I can give you the answer to the question, how is this happening to my child? But do you see how much sleight of hand is involved in that? Do you see what Dawkins is saying, the author of The Blind Watchmaker? He's saying, I can live consistently in this world as long as I shut off parts of human reality that point to an ordered universe, to a designed universe, and to a great creator. In precisely the same interview, Dawkins, who made some extraordinary confessions in it, incidentally, about his personal life as well as about his intellectual life. And the two, I think, are not at all unconnected. He said, but I can listen to a Bach B minor mass and weep and not know why I'm weeping. But you see what he does. He is to say, I can shut that off. I need find no explanation for that. I know the answer to the question, how is that happening in biological terms? But why it's happening in biological terms, to that question, why this moves me so deeply? Why it is that this expression in music of something that transcends my individual existence impacts on me in this way? I have no explanation for that. And you see in that very confession, he confesses the extent to which he cannot live consistently with his view of the universe in terms of the way in which he actually experiences the universe. Those of you who are interested in music, and those of you who are not at all interested in music, may know the name of John Cage, one of the more famous modern composers of the 20th century, an American who was born at the beginning of the 20th century. Cage developed a particular kind of philosophy that informed his music, the philosophy of indeterminism. And it was based on a view of the world, a kind of view that the world is all there is. And it was on that basis that he worked out his philosophy in terms of his music. Perhaps his most famous piece, at least the one with which I'm most familiar, indeed I could actually play it, believe it or not, written in 1954, is entitled 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds. A silent piece for any instrument or combination. And it's exactly that. And his whole point is that you just listen to whatever you can hear. Another piece he composed has 12 radios tuned to 12, or at least randomly tuned, to different stations, and orchestral accompaniment, or the accompaniment of a couple of dozen players and a conductor. What's he saying? He's saying that's the kind of world we live in. It was Francis Schaeffer, whose name is known to a somewhat older generation than some of us, who, on discovery of this, and on discovery that John Cage had a personal predilection for eating mushrooms, posed the question, when John Cage goes out into the forest to gather mushrooms, can he gather mushrooms on exactly the same basis in which he views the universe as an entirely random phenomenon? Of course he doesn't. He makes jolly sure that he doesn't pick up any toadstools in case he poisons himself. And Schaeffer's point, of course, was this. That may go down well with some musicologists, but you cannot live your life on the basis of that view of the universe, because the entire universe shouts at you, we don't exist like that. And so constantly, you see this all the time. The atheistic philosophy, the secular humanist, is always drawing on the capital of God's revelation, of God's creation, in order to try and live in the world which he or she denies that God has made. And this again is Paul's point. His point is that we are created in such a way that there is within us an echo of the divine. As I said last Sunday in the great, great words of Augustine, who went through all this in one lifetime, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. And you see that in your own life. You go perhaps denying the existence of God, and then there is yet another little explosion. It may be the life of a Christian. It may be some tragedy that takes place in your life. It may simply be the sight of something wonderful that makes you want to stand on tiptoe like these great photographs at sunset and say thank you until you suddenly remember, but I don't believe there's anybody there to thank. I mustn't do that. Although every instinct in you is saying thank you for this. It is, says the apostle, this this amazing fact that God has not only made us spectators of the wonder of his created order, but he's made us, as it were, walk-on actors in the drama of his revelation. And because we are made as the image of God, we simply cannot escape this sense that there is another. There is an extraordinary verse in the Old Testament in Leviticus 26:36 that Christians in another generation used to love to use in this context, where God says, I will make them jump at the sound of a falling leaf. Why do people do that? It is because of this deep down sense there is in the human being that there is another, that you are never actually alone and isolated and hidden in the universe. And it's all an expression of this awareness of God's presence that invades us. So there's a revelation of God's character that surrounds us. There's an awareness of God's presence that invades us. And do you notice also in the third place, Paul goes on to say that there is a knowledge of God that is actually suppressed by us. Look down at the language he uses. Begin with what he says here in the beginning of verse 21. They knew God. That's his starting place. They knew God. But what did they do with their knowledge of God? Verse 18. They suppress the truth. Verse 21. They knew God, but they did not glorify him as God. Verse 23, they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images. Verse 25, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. You see how carefully he has chosen very strong verbs. Suppress, that is, hold it down, hold it back. Exchange. I want something else. Refusing to glorify God. And so, verse 28, they eventually come to this. They did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. And he traces a movement in the individual that leads to a kind of intellectual futility that arises from the denial of the existence of God. An intellectual futility. I glanced during the week at a volume written by a great, great, great exponent of secular humanism in the natural order. Marvelous photographs, intricate details, extraordinary descriptions of the sheer wonder of nature. What's it all about? His conclusion: everything that exists, exists to pass on its genes to the next generation. And I thought of the words of the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes, vanity of vanity, everything under the sun is just vanity. And that's exactly what Paul is speaking about here. The rejection of God leads to an intellectual futility, because at the end of the day, there is no inherent point to anything. It leads also, he says, to a spiritual darkness. Verse 21, their foolish hearts were darkened. It leads to an arrogant folly. They thought that they were being wise, but they actually were behaving like fools. It leads to a false religion, and it does. It appears in all kinds of subtle ways, but it appears. If men will not worship the God of heaven, said G.K. Chesterton, the alternative is not that they will worship no God. The alternative is they'll worship anything. They will attribute to the slug in the slime honor and dignity and design and purpose and extraordinary reason that they will refuse to attribute to God. And it's often, do you notice, he says, connected to personal lifestyle. The question of morality appears here, and the way in which it invades eventually a whole society. What's the point he's making? The point he's making is this, that the rejection of God's being, his character and his presence is never exclusively an intellectual matter. Never. And the words he uses here are not merely intellectual words describing the thought processes of the individual. They are words that describe the motivations, the motives, the desires, the subtleties, and sometimes the darkness of the human heart. And the two things are always related. Scratch the rejecter of God, and underneath the scratch, there will always be the blood of personal moral alienation from God. It's not always obvious, but it's always there. I think one of the most striking illustrations of that I've ever read in my life, I found, and I'll tell you what the newspaper was in case you want to check it. It was the Daily Telegraph on the 23rd of October, 1996. It's a column that has at the top a photograph of Martin Amis, the novelist, and Salman Rushdie, the novelist. And its heading is Church Gathering for Atheist Amis. Martin Amis's father, Sir Kingsley Amis, undoubtedly one of the most talented novelists in the English language in the second half of the 20th century. Given Sir Kingsley Amis's professed atheism, it was perhaps unusual that his family and friends chose to congregate in a church to celebrate his life. Well, it was, wasn't it? Except that people are always borrowing on God's capital. Always borrowing on God's capital. I was taught psychology in university by a vice president of the British Humanist Association, and I've never forgotten how she came round the corner of some bookends in the university bookstore. And I recognized her voice immediately because I'd heard it so often in lectures. The vice president of the British Humanist Association asking one of the shop assistants, "Do you sell Christmas cards here?" You see? Borrowing. Borrowing, borrowing. Borrowing the pleasures, denying the underlying reality. Well, listen to this. It was a secular service, no hymns or prayers, just a lot of laughter. It began with Martin Amis, son and author. Now listen to this. Recalling a conversation his father had with Yevgeny Yevtushenko, the poet. Now, I think what lies behind this is that Yevtushenko, a Russian poet, had met Amis, thought that everybody in Britain was a Christian, discovered that Kingsley Amis made no Christian profession. Yevtushenko, the poet, asked him if he was an atheist. "Is it true, Sir Kingsley, that you're an atheist?" Now listen carefully to his answer. Listen very carefully to his answer. "Well, yes," said Kingsley. "But it's more than that. I hate him." You see? The man couldn't keep in the instinctive sense he had that it wasn't just an intellectual matter that he disbelieved in God. It was something rooted in his heart. Now, I make no value judgment on this, but it is amazing, absolutely amazing, how the next paragraph reads. And Caroline Davies, who wrote this, I don't know whether she's a Christian or not, whether she even thought for a moment of the connection, but listen to this. "It was also an occasion for those close to Sir Kingsley to meet. Hilly, his first wife, and now Lady Kilmarnock, and Elizabeth Jane Howard, the novelist, and the second wife, whom he refused to speak to after their divorce in 1983, were both present." Now, what does that tell you? That tells you something about a kind of chaos, all fronted, by a debonair atheism. And that's the point that Paul is making. You scratch a little behind the debonair atheism, and what do you discover? You discover at the end of the day that there is a deep-seated motivation in the human heart that will not have God, not because there is no knowledge of God. The darkness, says Paul, is not out there in God's revelation of himself. God's revelation of himself is crystal clear. The darkness is in here, because the darkness is in here, because I hate him, because I will not have him, because I will not bow before him. It's unlikely to be quite as dramatic as that, perhaps in your life or in my life, but it's the same sorry story. And that's why Paul, as he goes on in this letter to the Romans, tells us that if we are ever to not only recover the knowledge of God in creation, but to know God the way in which, as he understood the opening chapters of Genesis, men and women were originally created not simply to be like God, but to have fellowship with him. Do you remember how the story is told? Adam named all the animals, but there wasn't an animal that was really like him with whom he could have real fellowship. And so God made him a woman who would really be like him so he could have real fellowship with somebody else in the world, just as he had been made himself as the image of likeness of God so that he could have fellowship with God, friendship with God, communion with God, know God. And in the light of knowing God, see that this whole world was a vast mosaic displaying God's character, God's power, which God then said to him, Adam, go and explore it. Go and explore it. But now something extraordinarily radical is needed for this enmity of which Sir Kingsley Amos spoke. God needs to do something to bring about reconciliation. For this darkness in our minds, God needs to give illumination so that that darkness can be dispelled. For this heart of mine that is so at enmity with him and his desires to glorify myself rather than glorify God, there is a kind of regeneration needed, a reconciliation, an illumination, and a regeneration. And that, my friends, is why the Christian gospel is so satisfying, both intellectually and morally, spiritually and personally, because this is precisely what the Christian gospel tells us God has provided for us in the gift of his Son, Jesus Christ. He's provided reconciliation because God has, as it were, placed upon Jesus this hostility that has existed between himself and ourselves. And God, through Jesus and in his word, has given us spectacles, as it were, that make this confused world that we have so darkened by our failure to know and love God, that brings it all into focus. And he's given us regeneration that gives us new desires to love him and to love each other and to serve him and to explore and enjoy this world that he has made for us. So that in Christ's death, in Christ's word, in Christ's spirit, my three basic needs for restoration to know God intimately, personally, lovingly, are all given to me. That's why as Christians we want to say, we want to cry from the rooftops to our contemporary generation, that the Christian gospel, that Jesus Christ is not only morally satisfying, but he's gloriously intellectually satisfying, because he brings us back to the center. He brings us back to God. And we begin to see, as one of the hymn writers put it, that whereas this was a strange world in which we lived, we now see that something lives in every hue which Christless eyes have never seen. And we see these marvels of nature, we see the marvels of the discovery of science, and we no longer bow down before slugs and birds and animals and other such creatures and say, "How marvelous you are." But we bow down before the living God and we say, "Lord, how can this be true, that you who have made all this with the wonder of your mind desire also to know me, to love me, to trust me, to bring me into fellowship with yourself?" And that's the Christian gospel. That's the Christian faith. How do you know there's a God? Because you can't escape from him. But how do you know God? The only way, the apostle goes on to say, really to know God, is through faith in Jesus Christ.